Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. This is episode number 801. And I'm in Libertyville, Illinois at the Reformed Forum studio, headquarters, whatever we want to call it. We've got a recent tour of a blazing tour of our office was put on to social media by one of our staff members, Esther. So if you want to see what it looks like here, head on over to, I think, Facebook or Instagram. I definitely saw it on Instagram. But I have with me today some good brothers. It's time for Van Til Group, and that means that we have Reverend Dr. Carlton Wynn, who's assistant to the assistant pastor at, I know I'm teasing, he's at Westminster PCA in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome back, Carlton. It's good to see you.
It's great to be with you guys. So glad to be back for Van Til Group. I saw the tour of the Reform Forum headquarters, yeah. And it was neat. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're
that.
Hoping to have you here in a few days, maybe a week or so. I got to look next week, I think. We'll have you up and
it's
show
coming
you
up. Yeah, next month. I hope to see it for the first time with my own eyes.
Great. It's great. Yeah, we're very thankful to be here. It's a joy. So if people want to visit, let us know. You can send us a note at mail@reformedforum.org if you're ever in the Chicagoland area, especially up north. So we're kind of not quite half. We're a lot closer to Chicago, of course, but if you're on 94 in between Milwaukee and Chicago, we're real easy to get to. So maybe about 25 minutes north of O'Hare Airport. So pop on over. We'd love to meet you. We have with us, as you probably already heard and already have guessed, of course, Dr. Lane Tipton, who's the pastor of Trinity OPC and a fellow of Biblical and Systematic Theology here at Reformed Forum. Welcome back, Lane. It's good to see you, too.
That's great. I'm assistant senior pastor. No, it's great to be here. Wonderful time. Yes. And I am always uniquely excited for Van Til Group.
I think on the office tour, we did get, my wife told me, I didn't see it, but somebody commented and asked if you had an office. And he says, well, Lane lives in Philadelphia area. Yeah. He does not have an office here normally, but whenever he's in, which is probably about four times a year, the library has a desk, so we let him set up shop there. That's his kind of place for the visiting professor, assistant to the assistant visiting professor. So thank you. And we also have some big news, a little Van Til minutia, because Lane Tipton, you may see, is a little bit more zoomed out. That means the camera is a little further away from him than normal. And there's a reason for that, and it's because he has a new desk. Now, this is not just any normal desk. Lane, could you explain what desk you have and the story behind it?
Yes. We may want to have Chad Van Dixhorn on to give the story. He's so good at telling it. But long story short, I am sitting at the desk of Cornelius Van Til. Chad Van Dixhorn, dear friend of mine, acquired this a few months back and did work finishing it, in some ways refurbishing it, but keeping the texture and the grain and the character of the desk. And I moved it in just about 3 days ago. And I've got to tell you, it's made me want to work more diligently and faithfully than ever before. So it's really nice. And we ought to consider, I don't know if you ever want to do this, but we ought to have Chad come on sometime and tell the story behind his acquisition of the desk. And I've just been... Sure. I can't tell you, humbled, elated, delighted to have received this, and I am quite happy to be sitting in front of it. And the good news for all of the viewers is I am farther away from the camera because everyone knows I have a face for radio.
Can I say two things about the desk?
Yes.
Number one, Lane and Chad were speculating. There's a huge coffee mug ring on it, and Lane and Chad were speculating that that coffee ring was created when Van Til was reading Bart's Church Dogmatics.
Sure.
And just like left his coffee there because he was so flabbergasted as to what he was reading. But secondly, Lane has put his own touch on the desk. If we ever get to see a picture of it, he's got two lamps, and on the top of two lamps, he's got an OPC baseball cap
on each
one. Lamp.
Right.
Okay, so this
it's
is like
the cherubim.
This is a huge fire hazard. Like, we couldn't believe that he had these caps over these lamps. But Lane claims that these lamps have not burned up with caps on them for over a decade. So I said to Lane yesterday, if they ever burn up, he's going to have like two glory pillar witnesses on either side of the desk. But it may be the end of the desk very soon.
Well, if the glory pillars do erupt, it will be for reasons other than heat from the bulb, they're LED lights.
Okay.
So there's no heat, which is one good thing in the summertime. Not as good in the winter, but.
Brother, our conversation might light those things up.
They might light them on fire.
Hey, we're going to have to put a smoking study for sure at that point.
We'll see what we can do in terms of maybe inserting a photo in the graphic, finding one that Lane doesn't mind sharing, and then we'll stick that into the video feed.
My wife,
people,
Char did tell me that the ball caps, the OPC ball caps over the lamps, because I don't like direct light shining in my eyes ever.
Yeah.
She said it had a little bit of a dorm feel to it.
Oh, and more than that.
And I was
true.
Like,
it's insightful.
We need to just send you some video lights with the diffusers or a China ball or something like that, so that we'll dial it in for you. We'll get it set where you
get. Okay, you brothers can help me.
You can set your ambience the way you want. That's what we're doing
here,
playing around.
Thank
so
you.
Yeah. All right. Well, today we're going to be speaking about the defense of the faith. I've got my first edition copy here. We're going to put a reflection in. It'll make it refulge. It's refulgence. See, it's bright. We've got a wonderful hardcover edition of this, The Defense of the Faith by Cornelius Van Til. We're going to be marching through the next section. And this is going to be Van Til Group episode number 10. Of course, Christ the Center 801, but it's the 10th in our series walking through Van Til's book, The Defense of the Faith. Today, we're going to be looking at pages 58 through 63, covering man's knowledge of the world universe. Next time, Lord willing, and should be very soon because we're trying to record two of them today. So hopefully next month we'll have Sin and Its Curse covering pages 63 through 67. But these are very important, very classic Van Tilian ideas. Reading this is kind of like, for me, comfort food. You know, it's good, it's solid, it brings me home to my origins in the Reformed tradition. I grew up in the Mainline Presbyterian Church, a conservative local church, thankful for that. Grew up with Calvinist pastor, all this stuff, but I wasn't catechized. And then also I didn't have any philosophy training in university, but I learned much of that and came into the Reformed faith and the Westminster standards backwards by reading Cornelius Van Til sections like this in his book. And then starting to see how he interacted with the Reformed standards. And I was kind of catechized in reverse. You'd normally want to expect someone to be catechized as a child all the way up to being an adult and then maybe layering on the more advanced stuff. But that's not how I came to it. But the Lord works in mysterious ways, and I'm thankful for where I am and thankful to be here with two brothers that can talk about these topics with great erudition. That's a who knows where that pronunciation came from, but they are erudite. Carlton, why don't you start us off? We're looking here on page 58, and we're starting to see some, you know, important comments and Van Til's dealing with man's knowledge and God's knowledge. But they really the question of how does man know something? How does man know something about the world? And is this knowledge, can it be true and objective?
Yeah, thanks, Camden. I think it's helpful each time we get together to very quickly review where we are in the book in terms of its overall structure. So just very briefly, let's remember that Van Til is seeking to set forth a defense of the faith. He's especially seeking to answer critics of his Reformed apologetic approach. And that comes in part two, answering his critics. And he says he can't answer his critics until he properly sets forth the structure of his own thought, which is part one. He begins in chapter one, describing what we believe. What is the system of theology that arises from the scriptures? That's chapter one, Doctrine of God, Man, Christ, Salvation, the Church, the Last Things. As he moves into chapter two, he says we need to be able to make contact with non-Christian philosophers. We need to be able to use their language. But at the same time, we need to set forth a distinctively Reformed and Christian understanding of what philosophy generally studies, namely being, metaphysics, what is there, knowledge, how do we know what we know, the field of epistemology, and ethics. And so this is what Van Til's taking up in chapters 2, 3, and 4. Chapter 2, he titles A Christian Philosophy of Reality. where he sets forth the fundamental creator-creature distinction, walks through the eternal unity and plurality of the triune Godhead, and then speaks very briefly about sin and its curse. And then in chapter 3, he speaks about a Christian philosophy of knowledge. And then in chapter 4, he's going to get to ethics. But we're still in chapter 3 today on this 10th edition of the Van Til Group. And where have we gone in chapter 3? Well, Van Til has noted that a Christian theory of being, a creator-creature distinction, entails a Christian theory of knowledge. And he begins describing this Christian theory of knowledge by speaking first about God's exhaustive, personal knowledge of himself, that his knowledge is coterminous with his being because he is simple. And then in part two, he talks about God's knowledge of the world. You remember from last episode, we said, following Van Til, we said God's knowledge of himself and the world is simple and coterminous with his being. And yet we distinguish between God's necessary knowledge of himself and his free knowledge of everything that is not God. And we were careful to say, though God knows all that is not God, he knows all that is not God as God. He knows it exhaustively, analytically. That is, he doesn't have to undergo any investigation of the world. Indeed, we confess that he is the one who conceived the world as a reflection of his own glory. He posited the world of becoming and change and time. He in fact decreed all that would transpire in the cosmos before the foundation of the world. So the world is not something that's set over against God that he must investigate, but it is God who sovereignly and by the free determination of his own will posits the world and all that it contains and remains its sovereign and unchangeable Lord at every point in its history. Well, then in part three, we then speak about what does this imply for man's knowledge of God? And in short, things that we've covered so often, Van Til affirms that God's knowledge is absolute and original, and man's knowledge of God is a replica, it's analogical, it's finite, it's non-comprehensive, and yet it's true. And we're going to be coming back to those themes as we move on to the next section, which is man's knowledge of the world, man's knowledge of the world. So Van Til begins on page 58, discussing how does our knowledge of God, our finite, analogical, true but non-comprehensive knowledge of God by virtue of God's creative work and self-revelation, how does that knowledge of God on man's part relate to man's knowledge of his environment, the other finite things around him? And we might even include, how does it relate to man's knowledge of himself as an object of his thought as well? And here's what Van Til says at the beginning. What we have said about man's knowledge of God is really determinative for what we have to say about man's knowledge of the universe. By the term universe, we now mean the whole of the created world, including man himself and his environment. And then he asks this question. This is the first question that he posits. The first question we must ask with respect to the relation of our knowledge of God to our knowledge of the universe is, which of these two is prior? Now, I think as page 59 advances, we're going to see that by the word prior, at this point, Van Til means probably temporally prior. What is temporally prior? Now, Van Til is going to eventually answer that question by getting to which one is logically prior. He's going to say the question of temporal priority actually doesn't matter in the ultimate sense of the term. What really matters is the logical priority, which is logically prior, our knowledge of God or our knowledge of the universe. So Let's get into how he addresses this question, Lane, but let me just ask you this question on the outset. Sure. When he's talking about temporal and then ultimately logical priority, I have a hypothesis here that he's probably beginning a polemic against a Roman Catholic approach to knowledge of God implicitly. Mm-hmm. And narrowly, and yet he's probably also seeking to draw a distinction between a Christian and a non-Christian approach to man's knowledge of the world and God broadly. That's just a guess. Do you think that there's something to that? Like, why does he ask this question at the beginning of the section on our knowledge of the world?
Well, great question and fantastic overview. Here's my thought. I actually thought a little bit about that myself, Carlton. I think everyone who's listening should know that you and Camden and I aren't talking extensively before these. We're coming at it, having done our own work, maybe aware of some basic notes, but this is a true free-flowing conversation. Here's my thought. I'll give you my thought. I think he's probably got a two-pronged polemic going. On the one side, Thomas Aquinas and traditional Roman Catholic theology wants knowledge of sensible objects temporally to precede the knowledge of God. In natural knowledge of God for the traditional Roman Catholic, knowledge of God is last. It's at the end of an inferential process that traces back from sensible objects. But also, and I just did some lecturing on this at Reformed Forum headquarters last week, Kant believes virtually the same thing. He believes all knowledge in theoretical reason has sensible objects in view, and that what is known as the mind imposes the transcendental aesthetic of space and time, the transcendental analytic, the rational categories, what's known are only appearances of objects. You don't come to know the knowledge of God. And I think that when Van Til gets down to the very bottom of it, I think he's wanting to say something along these lines. We can fine-tune this if we want, because Van Til fine-tunes this elsewhere a little more tightly than he does here. But I think he leaves it kind of generally open because he's wanting to say something along the lines that in order to know, or in the process of knowing self and object, the unbeliever and believer alike know the environment in which they understand themselves and objects, and that environment is God. And so I think what he's trying to do here is get away from this idea that knowledge of self and objects is hermetically sealed, compartmentally distinguished from a knowledge of God, because God is going to be the revelational environment for the interpretation of anything. I think that's what he's after. So if that's true, and I'm not certain of that, Carlton, I haven't put enough work into it to be certain about this, but if that's true, I think he's saying something like this, that whether you go with the medieval dialecticism of Aquinas, nature, grace, or the modern dimensionalism of Kant, phenomena, noumena, the mind is really only knowing self and objects first, and then and only then addresses whether or not knowledge of God is attainable. And I think Van Til, with his comment about God as environment of interpretation and what he says elsewhere, I could read some quotes. I think he's trying to get us away from that, that dialectical nature grace medieval view of Aquinas, the dialectical noumenal phenomenal dimensionalism of Kant, I think.
That's very helpful. Let's pick up on that idea about God being the ultimate environment of man's knowledge of objects, because that's where he goes. He says, to answer this question, we need to remember our idea of God as exhaustively self-interpreted, exhaustively self-known, the fact that his knowledge of the universe is exhaustively known and interpreted and original to him. If I could, let me just read, I think we ended on this quote last time we were together, but just to remind our listeners, back on page 57, he says this: God certainly must have true knowledge of us and of the universe in general. Our existence and our meaning, our denotation and our connotation are derived from God. We are already fully interpreted before we come into existence. God knows us before and behind. He knows the thoughts of our hearts. We could not have existence and meaning apart from the existence and meaning of God. So he's picking up on that idea back on page 57 when he gets to this question of man's knowledge of the world. And he says, listen, if this is who God is, if we believe in a genuine creation of the absolute God, then it implies that God must be brought into the question of how man knows his environment. And the way that he is brought in is that we must acknowledge that he is the ultimate environment for all of our thinking, not only about God, but about our environment as well.
Yes.
And so he begins to reach this solution on page 59, I think with this quote. He says, God is man's ultimate environment, and this ultimate environment controls the whole of man's immediate environment as well as man himself. The whole of man's own immediate environment as well as man himself is already interpreted by God. Okay, this implies that if man is to have any true knowledge of the world around him, it must be God's interpretation of the world around him.
Yes.
And he, as the subjective knower, must know himself as the knower of his environment in accord with the way God has already pre-interpreted him, namely as his image. So then he says on page 59, thus we have answered our question about temporal priority by answering the question of logical priority.
Yes.
Our knowledge of God is logically prior to man's knowledge of the world because God is man's ultimate environment for knowing all things or anything at all.
One thing that I think needs to be said that we're assuming here, we're presupposing, the three of us, but it needs to be spelled out perhaps for some listeners, is just to revert back to the Bible's teaching on mankind being made in the image of God. There's so many implications for what that means with regard to our own epistemology, the context of our knowledge, the possibility of human knowledge. Everything Van Til develops throughout all of his theology comes back to that picture of, and that diagram he constantly draws of the two circles. And so often, various philosophies develop a theory of knowledge that makes man independent, or at best, like functionally deistic, that God would create man and then just kind of let him go off and do his own thing. You know, some Christian approaches to critical realism might be like that. But whatever we develop, whatever we say about man's knowledge, this idea that God is our ultimate environment or context has a lot to say about us being made in the image of God, but also even more than that, that God is the creator and the sustainer of the universe entirely. So Psalm 19 speaks about general revelation. You know, the heavens declare the glory of God and the earth is handiwork, etc. There's nothing we can go to. There's nothing we can look at and not have God revealed therein. That's because everything depends upon him. So Van Til, in my opinion, is just merely trying to draw out the philosophical and specifically epistemological implications of an orthodox doctrine of God. It's really that basic. Yeah. Although he develops it in really wonderful ways, and he is extremely intelligent in applying this theology to a field where it hadn't necessarily been applied as consistently as this to this point. But that's really what's going on. So I think that helps. That helped me a lot when I was cutting my teeth on Van Til to learn the Orthodox doctrine of God and then apply it to the field of apologetics and all of its subdisciplines. But really, at least, I don't know if you two brothers agree, but this is really what I think is at the heart of this. It's just, it doesn't need to be, it's complicated. It can be hard for people to understand, but I want to encourage people that it doesn't need to be that hard to understand or access. Like sometimes we might be overthinking this point.
I could not agree more. And to just confirm or affirm, not that it needs to be confirmed, just to affirm what you brothers have said. I think if you remember, Van Til elsewhere very clearly says that following Calvin, God, man does not know himself first and afterwards know God. The knowledge of self and the knowledge of God, Van Til says, according to Calvin, is included in one act of thought. So that we know God in knowing self. You can remember that from pages 98, 99 of the survey. So the environment of Adam before the fall was exhaustively revelational. Whether he looked inside or outside, there was natural revelation of God confronting him. The special terms of the covenant confronted him in special revelation. But what Van Til's adding here that you both have highlighted is this, and this is so critical, that what God reveals is an exhaustive, what resides in God as he reveals himself is an exhaustive interpretation of all reality, rooted in God's comprehensive, simple foreknowledge, his free knowledge of all that is not God. And he knows that as God knows it, eternally, intuitively, and exhaustively. God's plan is in back of all things. And in terms of that, God creates all things. And so every single fact in the environment of revelation has been exhaustively interpreted by God because it's exhaustively foreknown by God, eternally foreordained by God, brought into existence by God, and upheld by God. And his word is the accommodated form of that interpretation. And so it's really, it is so simple. It's the environment is exhaustively revelational in nature and in covenant or scripture after the fall. And the God who's revealing himself knows, controls, interprets all things and makes that known in his word. It's beautifully simple, even though it is deep and profound.
Yeah, that's great, Lane. You know, sometimes we text before we start recording, and I hope it's okay if I just read one little thing that I texted you this morning before we started recording. I said, whenever I think I'm lost reading Van Til, he always comes back to the absolute God, the comprehensive decree, the all-controlling power of his providence, and therefore the real historical events of the world, common grace, etc., all with a focus on the regenerating power of Christ speaking in the scriptures. And he comes back to it again and again. If I could pick up on something you said earlier, Lane, about alternative approaches to the knowledge of the world, you said that, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but Kant and post-Kantian philosophy is essentially going to view the human subjective knower and his knowledge of the world as hermetically sealed, as kind of self-contained, apart from God at a minimum. It's not bringing God in at the outset of that subject-object relation.
Absolutely.
And then the Roman Catholic approach is going to not hermetically seal, but it's going to treat man's knowledge of the world as logically and temporally foundational for man's knowledge of God.
Yes.
And the reason at the beginning of our recording I said I think he might have an implicit polemic going against that particular Roman Catholic approach is because I remembered a quote later in Defense of the Faith on page 317. And this, I think, has always really captured the antithesis for me between the two approaches. I'll just read it to you. I know I'm reading it to you cold here, but page 317, the Romanist evangelical type of apologetics assumes that man can first know much about himself and the universe, and afterward, and that quote, that word is italicized in the original, and afterward ask whether God exists and Christianity is true. The Reformed apologist assumes that nothing can be known by man about himself or the universe unless God exists and Christianity is true. And if I'm stepping back from that quote, I think the two key words there are afterward and unless.
Yes.
The approach of the Romanist evangelical type, let's just leave apologetics aside, let's just say the Romanist evangelical approach to man's knowledge of the world and knowledge of God begins first with knowledge of the world, and then afterward asks, how does this bear on our knowledge of God? How does this enable us to arrive at a knowledge of God? How does this enable us now on the far end of our sense impressions of the world to say things about God? And yet the Reformed approach, Van Til is saying, is that no, even our sense impressions of the world, even our knowledge of the world, cannot proceed. It cannot even get off the ground unless the knowledge of God is operating as concreated and impressed upon man's heart and is logically foundational to anything true that we say about the world in which we live.
Yeah, Carlton, I think that is incisive and extremely useful to buttress this point Van Til's making earlier on. And we can adapt what I read earlier from the survey and say this: not only is man himself revelational of God, so that in knowing himself, he knows God, but Van Til in the survey and in other places makes explicit that when man knows any logical principle or any empirical fact, in knowing principles, laws, and facts outside of himself, he is likewise knowing God. Why? Because all knowledge of self and world, whether that is logical principles, quote-unquote first principles, or sensible objects, all of created reality carries with it the revelational impress of God himself. So that and it's just that principle, that sensus divinitatis, where knowledge of self includes knowledge of God, knowledge of the world includes knowledge of God. It's that principle that I think Van Til keeps invoking. And the only way you get to that principle, the only way you do it, is if you reject the Roman Catholic, Socinian, Arminian doctrines of the image of God, reject the natural theology of Rome, and affirm a Reformed doctrine of image and covenant pre-fall, where there's an environment of revelation within and without. So I think it really is, to come back to Camden's point, I think it's just that basic. Van Til keeps coming back to the basics and is never really leaving them. And that might be why some people think it sounds so profound, because those basics aren't always brought in at such profound levels, but he keeps doing it.
Okay, so what would Van Til say? And I've got a quote kind of on the side here on page 59, but what would Van Til say if an objector came and said, hey, you talk about revelational impress being operative at the outset of any act of human knowing of self and the world. You know, when I was younger, I just looked around at the world, and it wasn't until I got into college that I even believed that God existed. You know, it was far down the road, and I had gone through all of my sort of preschooling and learned a ton about the world around me before I ever knew God. What would Van Til say about that temporal autobiographical statement?
That's where he brings in eventually the epistemological psychological distinction. I think we need to start with the Bible, what the Bible teaches. Romans 1, 18 through 21, it's very clear that all men know God but suppress the truth in unrighteousness. But if we develop this further, I think there are different senses in which we can speak about knowledge. And there can also be a difference or a distinction between knowing God and suppressing the truth, and then you know, having a developed epistemological knowledge or even a conscious awareness. So it's, I don't think Van Til is saying that knowledge of God is prior to knowledge of anything else, in the sense that someone is going to have a fully developed, explicit, knowledge that they could articulate in language. That we're talking about something much deeper than that, more fundamental, more basic. It's not unrelated to that, but that's where some of the nuance is. And I think that's where some of the critics of Van Til go horribly wrong, is they have no awareness of the nuance of Van Til's use of this, which is really just stemming from, exegeting certain biblical passages. He's not just going out and speculating. He's seeking to account for what the Bible's teaching, but also understanding that that we need to recognize some differences in the world that we experience.
Yeah. And picking up on that, Camden, and staying on your question, Carlton, I've got this one highlighted. Van Til puts it this way: even if in our psychological experience, quick bracket, psychological experiences, my own rendering, assume I'm an unbeliever, my own rendering, according to my own espoused presuppositions of what I was thinking when I was 17 years old. Even if in our psychological experience, we know ourselves and the universe about us before we speak self-consciously about God, we have all the while known God if we have truly known anything else. I think he's getting at this, and Camden's appealed to it. Romans 1, 18 through 20, 1 and following. God has revealed himself plainly so that men are without excuse. There's the objective fact, the epistemological situation. He's made himself known to all so that they're without excuse. But what do they do? They suppress that knowledge of God in unrighteousness, and in their psychological experience, worship idols, start with raw empirical data according to their own espoused presuppositions, and understand the world psychologically in terms of those espoused presuppositions. Yet, deep down, in terms of who they are as image bearers, they know this God. They suppress his truth and unrighteousness. And so I think Van Til's saying this, that before you even begin to speak self-consciously about God, in all forms of psychological experience, when you're dealing with the world, dealing with data of experience, he said, the fact that you don't speak self-consciously of God does not mean that all the while you knew him in suppression, in rebellion, and in self-deception. So I think, Carlton, I might be wrong, and please, if I'm missing where you were wanting to go in that direction, but I think that's at least one thing Van Til might try to bring up, which Camden already appealed to. And it's just that dynamic between what the believer really knows as the image of God, yet suppresses and redirects in terms of sinful self-deception.
Yeah, no, that was the quote that I had holding it off to the side there, the psychological self-experience before we speak self-consciously of God. One illustration might be, hey, I spoke many words until I was 17 before I realized I was breathing oxygen, you know? Like, just because you discover oxygen later in life doesn't mean that even before you spoke a word, that oxygen was sustaining your existence. And so, yes, Camden, we when we speak of knowledge of God, so often people miss that Van Til's talking about that stamped knowledge of God on the heart that is inescapable, and that the environment is constantly pressing in upon the fallen sinner. And we'll get to sin a little bit later, but yeah, very good.
No, real quickly, I may have misspoke here. I just don't want to mislead our listeners, and Camden probably picked up on this. Van Til calls the psychological the true state of affairs, what God has impressed upon the mind as an image bearer. Often when he's talking about unbelievers, he calls the epistemological what they espouse.
Yeah, the ethical,
yeah. And so, you know, to use that example about the oxygen, I think when it comes to the psychology, the unbeliever deep down knows he's breathing oxygen, deep down knows that he knows God. But in terms of his conscious, espoused, formal expressions, in terms of his worldview, he does not know God. He presents the case as though he is not in contact with God or his right. revelation. That would be the epistemological.
And that could be theoretical.
I was a little unclear on that early.
That epistemological angle could be theoretical, or it could just be the way someone lives. It doesn't have to mean that you have a developed system that you're telling people or writing down in textbooks. It's just, you know, you're acting as if you are an atheist, practically. So, Carlton,
I just wanted to clarify that because I felt like I was a little unclear earlier.
That's good. The psychological is the implanted, and the epistemological is what non-believers espouse. As I look at page 59, I think psychological experience, he might be using psychological in the sense that you originally said it, Lane. Like, I don't know. I'd have to look at that. But I think he's saying, even if in our psychological experience, we know ourselves in the universe before we speak self-consciously of God, is that word self-consciously that makes me think psychological experience is autobiographical, what I'm espousing.
I think you're right. I think you're right.
Though elsewhere, he will say at a psychological, at a soul level, the psuche, you know, there are no atheists, and epistemologically, after the fall, all men are atheists. But good clarification. That will be helpful to the listener later on. Well, brothers, as we go ahead, the next topic that he tackles, if you don't mind, is on page 60, he says, it follows from all this that we know the world truly, though not comprehensively. You know, he takes so much of what he said about our knowledge of God, that it's true, analogical, but not comprehensive, and he kind of transposes that into this discussion of man's knowledge of the world, namely that it can be true and is true, but never comprehensive. Okay, as I'm thinking about the subject-object relation, it got me thinking. He says this is only possible as we bring in the relation of both the object and the subject to the knowledge of God, right? So God is the ultimate environment. He is the one that pre-interprets both subject and object. We must recognize this if we're to have any real contact and the possibility for any contact between the subject and object. And he says that we may debate endlessly about psychological problems if we refuse to bring in basically God. He says if we refuse to bring in the metaphysical question of the nature of reality. So it just got me thinking about the subject-object relation and these kind of endless debates without fruitage, as Van Til puts it, regarding the subject-object relation. And I think it might be useful to maybe survey some of the problems that arise without God in terms of the subject-object. And what is just at a broad level the debate that goes on in terms of subject and object? Lane, you're going to be helpful here. But I just jotted down two definitions of two terms, namely realism and anti-realism. Realism is the belief that there are real entities that exist outside of our minds. But I seem to recall, I'm going back to like Bahnsen lectures on realism and how he threw up objections outside of God by saying, how do we know these things outside of our minds? How do we justify it? And I remember him saying, like, what about dreams that you have? Where you seem to be experiencing something outside of your mind, but it's actually not true. You know, what about Kuhnian paradigms that inform our the way we do science that eventually reach a crisis point and there's a paradigm shift. What about when we see a quarter on the ground at an angle and it kind of looks like an oval? Okay, we're getting into treacherous philosophical waters, but for all these reasons, some have said, no, we shouldn't be realists. We should be anti-realists. And I think this is kind of where we're living today, some kind of anti-realism, where everything is socially constructed, where there are no real mind independent existences, that all we have are man-made human concepts to understand the world around us. You know, you brought up Kant. Kant would say we actually don't know the thing in itself outside of our minds. We just know the way that our minds put together the sense data that we experience. So I don't know, we can move past this very quickly, but I find it fascinating that if you survey the history of sort of philosophy on these questions, there are endless debates about the nature of the knowledge of the world. Yes. And while yes, we have to acknowledge the influence of subjective baggage and lenses that we bring and misperceptions that we have, and you know, the impact of sin on our understanding of the world, what Van Til is setting forth here is a kind of global justification for objective knowledge of the world, but it has to come with a firm belief in God's self-disclosure as the absolute God of heaven and earth. Any thoughts on the endless debates between subject and object, if I can take you back to your philosophy days, Lane?
Yes, sure. I remember especially when I was studying with Bahnsen, he talked about the problem of perspectivism when it comes to realism, and the way that if you look at take the quarter as an example of knowing an object, you're going to give so many discrepant accounts of the quarter. If it's close before you upright, if it's 3 feet away from you lying on a table, the perceptual conditions and distance and geography and lighting and all of those things come into play in such a way that you wind up giving what appears to be mind-dependent accounts of the object. Likewise, on the other side, with the realist says minds conform to objects, but that act of conformity winds up being so varied, so complex, that to give an adequate account of that object, you're almost moved to say that it can be accounted for only when omnipresent conditions can all be accounted for, when you can view it perfectly with the God's eye view. And I think that what happens there is very close to the idealist proposal of Kant, that the mind is imposing spatial, temporal, geographical, logical categories onto objects, and it is mind dependent activity that confers that. And I think Van Til's saying this, and not to get into an adequate discussion of realist, anti-realist, realist, idealist debates, but I think Van Til's saying is this, that if from the outset you assume that the subject-object relation among finite beings, finite subjects, finite objects, you are going to be lost in an endless labyrinth of dead-end philosophical discussions that get you virtually nowhere. Endless psychological problems arise for the critical realist and the subjective or transcendental idealist, looking like they're, you know, ultimately reducing them to just family resemblances, to bring Wittgenstein into it. And Van Til's saying that the problem with that is neither are both of them are taking the subject and object relation as epistemologically most basic, finite subject, finite object as most basic. And Van Til's saying everything changes if we have a God who, A, in his language here, has adapted the finite subject to the finite object and vice versa, and B, is himself the ultimate interpreter of reality in the sense that his free knowledge, his plan, his work of creation exhaustively determine and confer meaning on objects, give them intrinsic intelligibility and place them in an organic relation to finite minds. And we then, as such creatures, interpret his thoughts after him and his revelation. Van Til says, if you draw those two circles and those two lines and make that relation central, you bypass, by and large, endless psychological problems with univocal approaches that say, like the realists, hey, minds conform to objects, and idealists, no, objects conform to minds. Van Til saying, a pox on both houses, that's right. Univocal, that's anti-Christian. We must begin with God as the ultimate subject of interpretation and think his thoughts after him.
Lane deals with this really well in the 8th Van Til course that's in the can. We're working on editing that, the one on idealism, so you have some early lectures on that. But I remember reading so much on the active intellect, and Thomistic conceptions of epistemology, and then how those were reinterpreted and understood, you know, according to post-Kantian philosophy, like figures like Karl Rahner and whatnot, where you have this active intellect, this agent intellect, which goes out and surveys various objects in the world and then creates some sort of phantasm, which is kind of like downloads a copy of it and then investigates it. There are all these accounts for how to do this and trying to explain how humans can know. So we want to affirm that there are objects that exist outside of our minds, that live and exist. They're independent of our perception of them. Yeah, absolutely. This we affirm against, you know, the true Kantians and whatnot. But as you said, Lane, the problem with all of these approaches is basically they are univocal, or they're God independent. And if you deny the orthodox doctrine of God, or if you have an orthodox doctrine of God conceptually, but you're not putting it into practice in the rest of your investigations academically, then you're going to end up at a dead end, because you can't account for the way the world is. By impossibility of the contrary, we need the triune God, the self-contained triune God who has revealed himself in Scripture, at the center of all of it, including our doctrine of knowledge, our epistemology. So realism or anti-realism, if it's the human mind working on its own, whether investigating objects outside of itself to figure out what they mean on its own, or the objects or the perceptions thereof being dependent on the mind themselves, you've got the same problem at the end of the day.
Two final thoughts, I think. One very quick. Number one, I just really like it that Camden said in the 8th Van Til class that Lane recorded. And secondly, as we think about the relationship of God to all that we know, I think one kind of general category that brings us to the close of this section is that Van Til feels the need to say, look, On a Christian position, we're not saying we have exhaustive knowledge of the world around us. Indeed, it can never be comprehensive. And it can never be comprehensive because everything that we know in the world is related to the incomprehensible God. And what does that imply? It implies, and I love this, it implies that there is a mysterious depth dimension to all human knowledge of the world around us. Because the world around us, including ourselves, reveal something of the glory of the incomprehensible God. So how does Van Til close this section on 61? He says we need to say a word about antinomies and the paradoxes, the seeming contradictions that are embedded in all knowledge of the world, because it can never be comprehensive. We never have an exhaustive understanding of the relationship between object A and object B, because we don't have an omniscient understanding of the divine decree that situates those objects within a comprehensive plan that has the glory of God as its final telos. So he ends on a very, even this may sound very abstract and like, what are you saying? There's a paradox in all of human knowledge of the world. Well, he gives a very concrete example. He says we have to recognize that all knowledge is analogical and paradoxical, that all of our knowledge takes place in time and space, and yet it's all determined and pre-interpreted by the infinite, non-temporal, non-spatial God. And this means that everything that we know, here's the final way I think I'd put it. Everything that we know takes place within the time-space manifold. And yet at the same time, quote unquote, it's determined by the exhaustive decree of the unchanging God. That is the, I think, the most fundamental paradox in all of human knowledge of the world. It's determined by the unchanging God who has decreed all things, and yet as we know things in the world, it's new for us, and it's situated within time and space. And the very practical example that Van Til gives is prayer, right? Like events in time and space regarding things that we know, things that we would like to see. All of it has been predetermined by God, and yet our prayers, quote unquote, change things. God hears our prayers. He weaves our prayers into his sovereign decree. And if he didn't answer prayer, Van Til says he wouldn't be God. So the paradox of human knowledge, the paradox of the outworking of the divine decree. And then Van Til ends with this. He says, look, the non-Christian's going to look at this and think it's absurd. He's going to think that you've got a full bucket of water. And is this the first time we reach the full bucket difficulty? Maybe he's mentioned,
I think
it
so.
Before.
It will.
Oh. It will not. And it will not be the last. But the non-Christian says we have a full bucket of water, and yet history is real and meaningful, and you're trying to add water to a bucket that's already full. How can this be? And Van Til says, look, unless you have an absolute God, you can't even have water or a bucket, essentially.
Yes. And Carlton, you know what I find fascinating about this? I want to keep this focused on the worship of the immutable triune God who controls all things by his immutable plan, yet gives creatures authentic freedom, yet prayer changes things. If God were to become mutable and ignorant and developmental like the creature, then everything Van Til says about mystery falls to the ground. The whole conception of mystery that he's setting forth requires an infinite, eternal, and omniscient triune creator who works all things according to the counsel of his immutable will and gives creatures freedom in that context and not apart from it. If God developed a new temporal and ignorant mode of existence in relation to the creature, the mystery would no longer be how an immutable God relates to the mutable creature and gives that creature authentic freedom. It would be how in the world did the immutable God become his opposite, right? It'd be the mystery of pantheism or the mystery of mutualism, the mystery that Barthes would embrace. And so it's really quite astonishing that for Van Til, apparent contradiction is the immutable, simple, triune creator relating to the creature and giving that creature freedom and meaning. And real contradiction for Van Til is denying that the creator, the triune creator, is simple, immutable, and omniscient in his relation to creation, denying that he controls all things according to his immutable will and plan.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Amen. Yeah, once again, I adapt this phrase all the time, but the absolute God and his absolute decree is the Magna Carta for Christian liberty. It's here. It's the Magna Carta for Christian knowledge of the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, this has been really fun. Very enlightening. It's very useful to work through these pages. We've worked through 58 through 63 in Van Til's book, The Defense of the Faith, and we look to be back, Lord willing, next month, talking about the next section, both with Carlton Wynn and Lane Tipton, our panelists, co-hosts today. Head out over to reformedforum.org for information about all of our programs, courses, upcoming events, and publications. Again, the full Van Til curriculum has now been recorded, but the sixth Van Til course has been released. I'm working on, our staff is working on tidying up and developing the seventh course for our online learning platform and to get it out onto YouTube. And I'm editing the eighth course. So look for that probably in July for the eighth and sometime soon, hopefully for the seventh. So lots of material. And really, thank you, Lane, for all your work there. It's really a tremendous thing to have all those eight courses completed. And we're looking forward to people around the world being able to learn about Van Til and about this applied apologetic, not just in these current times, but also for many, many years to come. So that's all online at reformedforum.org. If you have any comments or questions, send us a note, mail at reformedforum.org. And I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.